Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Efforts to address the potential impact of a massive planned data center in Newcastle County continue, including a bill from State Senator Stephanie Hansen to add oversight.
It's probably fair to say that this is a work in progress, but you can't discount the fact that there really does appear to be broad-based support for the bill.
Contributor John Hurdle examines this bill and other plans to deal with data centers and their electric use. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also look back on the successful college football campaigns at Delaware and Delaware State this fall. And Arts Playlist previews a downstate performance of Handel's Messiah this holiday season. It's all next on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. As 2025 comes to a close, efforts to address a plan to build one of the largest data centers in the country near Delaware City in Newcastle County and its potential impact on electric rates in the first state remain a work in progress. This week, Delaware Public Media contributor John Hurdle takes a look at where things stand on multiple fronts in this ongoing battle, and he joined me earlier this week to discuss what he learned. So as always, I think it's useful to kind of remind people what this proposed data center would look like, its expected footprint. Just remind us what we're talking about here in terms of what this data center could look like.
Well, this would be one of the biggest industrial plants ever built in Delaware. This is 6 million square feet is proposed on two sites near Delaware City. And crucially, it would use 1.2 gigawatts of electricity. That is more than some of the offshore wind farms that have been proposed off of Delaware, and is actually half of what the entire state of Delaware uses in a year. So that helps to put this this project into perspective.
And as you've reported previously and in your latest piece, the developer Starwood Digital Ventures is not offering much in the way of assurances that local ratepayers will not see higher bills as the result of their project, correct?
That is correct. Yes. Back in October, Starwood said, and I quote, "It does not expect the data center to result in a significant long-term impact to residential rates." And that's the end of the quote. It did not deny that residential rates probably will be affected in some way. But some people are saying that there's inevitably rates are going to go up simply because demand is going to exceed supply. One analysis of this was done by the environmental group Natural Resources Defense Council, and they did an estimate for how ratepayers would be affected throughout the area of the 13 state area covered by the grid operator PJM. And what NRDC found is that the average ratepayer in the PJM area, which of course includes Delaware, would pay an extra $70 a month in electricity bills by 2028.
Is that kind of the best estimate we have right now, or maybe even the only estimate right now, of what specifically it could do to rates?
Well, in my reporting, I haven't come across any specific projections for what's going to happen to electric rates in Delaware. In part, I think it reflects the fact that that Project Washington is in its early planning stages. It's not expected to be up and running fully for probably about another decade. But its developer Starwood says is that the revenue earned from the new center will eventually help PJM and the utilities pay for transmission upgrades that would be needed anyway because of an increased demand, not only from data centers, but also from other increases in electrification, like electric vehicles, for example. But policymakers and consumer advocates in Delaware are saying that the big new demand by Project Washington will drive up rates for everyone else simply because supply won't be able to keep up with demand.
So let's talk a little bit about efforts to address this issue. And one that seems to have a reasonable measure of support is at the state level. That's Senate Bill 205. What would that bill do?
Well, what that would do is empower the Public Service Commission to issue what they call a certificate to operate to any new business that draws at least 30 megawatts. That, of course, is a lot less than would be used by this proposed data center. And the PSC would issue this certificate based on whether the proposed facility is would supply all or most of the power that it needs, how that plant would affect ratepayers, how it would affect the state's economy, and how it would affect the state's efforts to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. I mean, so what the lead sponsor of the bill, that is Democratic State Senator Stephanie Hansen, says is that this is not an attempt by the legislature to control the data center industry, but merely, it is a effort to empower or to give the PSC the authority that it needs in order to make sure that this gigantic project doesn't have the negative effects that some advocates say it will.
And one of the things that Senator Hansen notes the bill tries to do is be realistic about getting data centers to provide their own power while understanding that these centers likely are coming online before any power generation infrastructure upgrades can really be done in the state. Can you explain kind of the needle she's trying to thread here?
Well, Hansen recognizes the high cost and the very long timelines involved in any attempt to add power generation, and whether that's from natural gas or from other forms of fossil fuels, or even in fact from offshore wind. And she says that requiring big energy users like this data center, for example, to provide 100% of their own power would mean that they would be prevented from building. And that, of course, would mean that the state would miss out on the economic benefits, job creation, and tax revenue addition that the developer says will accrue from this project.
And it does seem like this effort, Senate Bill 205, does have fairly broad, maybe even bipartisan support, right?
Well, it does appear that way. The governor supports it. The PSC supports it. The State Energy Office, the Delaware Public Advocate, 12 Democratic lawmakers have signed on to this bill so far. And I've even somebody on the other side of the aisle, Republican State Senator Bryant Richardson, said that he doesn't have a problem with the bill's provisions so far, and he might actually vote for it. So there does appear to be broad-based support for this bill, yes.
So that's one track that the state is pursuing. Another is a large load tariff. Can you tell us a little bit about that, and where does that effort stand?
Well, large load tariff would be a higher rate for big energy users to pay for upgrades in transmission infrastructure. PSC opened a docket, that is a working plan, to develop a large load tariff, and that was back in September, after getting a petition from the public advocate and the staff of the PSC. And what they say is that docket will temporarily pause the interconnection with the grid of large load facilities until that large load tariff is set.
There is also, John, an effort outside of the state to address this issue, and it involves the grid operator you mentioned earlier, PJM Interconnect. What is it considering, and where does that stand?
At PJM, of course, this is the nation's largest grid operator, and they invited proposals. They've got a stakeholder process, and they invited proposals to develop rules that would prevent rate increases or even blackouts for the approximately 67 million people who live in their region. And the board was due to consider these proposals, including those from Delaware, last month, but none of those dozen or so proposals got a so-called passing grade, so the board won't be formally taking those into account, but the board is expected later this month to deliver its decision on what, if any, measures it proposes to take region-wide.
So until recently, John, it appeared that Newcastle County might be the front line in addressing this proposed data center and its impact via an ordinance sponsored by Councilman Dave Carter. Carter offered a substitute version of his measure at one point to kind of court the needed support to pass it. But now it seems other council members are putting up some pretty major roadblocks. Where does Councilman Carter's effort stand right now?
Well, Carter says he's working with Newcastle County planners to see if his proposed ordinance can be salvaged in a form that that satisfies the objections of the two other council members who proposed amendments. And now the council tabled Carter's proposed ordinance, and he says he's the only person, the only council member who has the authority to take it off the table. But he doesn't know whether the review by county planners is going to be complete in order for to be able to take the motion off the table and to have a vote on it at the next council meeting on December 9th.
And Carter has essentially said that the ordinance amendments that have been offered would essentially gut the bill, correct? Like he feels like the effort by these other council members Toole and Kirkpatrick are basically kind of cutting the ordinance off at the knees.
Well, that's correct. And Carter says he doesn't know where. He specifically addressed Councilwoman Kilpatrick's objections to this, and he says he doesn't really know where she's coming from, but she appears to be trying to defeat the ordinance, which he says, and if she succeeds, he says that would be in keeping with the demands of property developers and fossil fuel interests.
Now, Starwood's efforts to lobby for its project and against Carter's ordinance have really centered around the economic upside that you mentioned earlier that they believe the project would bring to Delaware. But Carter is pushing back on that as he continues to try to get this ordinance to the finish line. What are the concerns he's bringing up regarding the economic benefits that are being attributed to this by Starwood?
Well, Carter says Starwood hasn't explained how it calculated its claims on tax revenue and job creation. He says tax revenue, the tax revenue projections by the company are high, and he raises examples of previous industrial projects that haven't lived up to promises of economic benefits. And he cites Fisker, Bloom Energy, and the expansion of AstraZeneca, all of which have received incentives of various kinds. But he said there wasn't what he calls due diligence on those projects. And clearly, he fears that the same is or will be true of Project Washington. And that's why he says the public deserves to know exactly how the company came up with these numbers. And by the way, Starwood says that that when Project Washington is up and running, it will result in $77 million a year in tax revenue for Newcastle County.
Starwood's argument on economic impact has garnered some support, specifically from local unions, which showed up in force at the recent Newcastle County Council meeting when Carter's ordinance was tabled. It seems like, at least in that regard, they have found some support, right?
There was a very fulsome statement issued by the union, a statement of support. 20 local unions representing about 4,800 plumbers, metal workers, roofers, and other trades signed a project labor agreement to cooperate with Project Washington. So yes, we can say that the local unions are on side here.
And certainly that has had a bit of an impact on the county level efforts and arguments and debate. John, as we wrap up, based on what we're seeing right now, does it appear the most likely place we're going to see some meaningful regulation of data centers, and specifically this one, Project Washington, will come at the state level, at least the way things stand right now?
Well, I think it's probably fair to say that this is a work in progress. I mean, on one side, we've got Starwood saying that the pushback to start to Carter's ordinance in Newcastle County shows public support is building, and the company is predicting that Hanson's bill at the state level will see a similar fate. It will be watered down. But I mean, you can't discount the fact that there really does appear to be broad-based support for the bill, and you know that suggests that it has a pretty good chance of becoming law.
Thanks to contributor John Hurdle for his time this week. You can find John's piece updating efforts to mitigate the impact a massive data center proposal in Newcastle County could have on electric bills right now at DelawarePublic.org. And stay with us. We delve into this year's successful college football campaigns at Delaware and Delaware State with News Journal Delaware Online sports writer Kevin Tressolini. That's next on The Green here on Delaware Public Media. Hi, I'm Delaware Public Media News Director Tom Byrne, host of The Green, taking a moment from today's show to ask you to support Delaware Public Media's year-end fund drive. We are trying to fill the loss of federal funding, and for us, that means $165,000 per year each year going forward. We can only overcome that with you, the public in Delaware Public Media. You're listening to The Green, so we know you value what this show brings you each week. Award-winning, in-depth stories and conversations focused solely on the First State, like the piece you just heard on efforts to address the impact of a massive proposed data center, or the conversation you're about to hear about the success Delaware and Delaware State's football teams had this year. What we're asking for you to do is head to DelawarePublic.org and support that work with a one-time donation of $50, $100, or $200, or a recurring monthly gift of $10, $15, or $25. It all helps us fill that annual loss of $165,000 in federal funding each year. Please head to DelawarePublic.org and donate. And again, thanks for listening to The Green here on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. The 2025 college football season in the First State was one of transition. The University of Delaware made its debut in the Major College Football Bowl subdivision, going 6-6 overall and 4-4 in Conference USA. More importantly, it managed, with a little help, to earn bowl eligibility and will play in a bowl game later this month. Meanwhile, Delaware State made a remarkable turnaround in its first season under its new head coach, former Philadelphia Eagle great DeSean Jackson. Jackson took the Hornets from 1-11 last year to 8-4 this year, and DSU fell just one win shy of its first MEAC title since 2007 and its first ever bid to the Celebration Bowl. Earlier this week, News Journal Delaware Online sports writer Kevin Tressolini joined me to discuss how the Blue Hens and Hornets made waves this season and what the future might hold for each squad. We'll start with the University of Delaware, where they made the big move up to the Football Bowl subdivision. And I imagine if you told UD coach Ryan Carty and other UD officials that they would finish 6-6 overall, 4-4 in Conference USA, and head to a bowl game, they probably would have signed up on the spot. You couldn't really have asked for much more reasonably, could you?
No doubt about it. To go 6-6 and get a bowl bid, we don't know yet where they're going, but they're going to go somewhere, is quite an achievement for a first-year program. You know, the ironic thing about it is Delaware feels like they should have been even better. You know, they lost a couple really tough games. They won a couple really close down-to-the-wire games. I mean, some of these games were just absolutely riveting. And that was one of the really cool things about this year, because they played better teams on a regular basis. You didn't have, you know, the blowout every three or four games that you would always get in past Delaware seasons. Like, you knew every game was going to be a contest. And you know, again, you know, Delaware lost a couple that probably should have won, but also probably won a couple that could have lost. So 6-6 is a nice way to finish in retrospect when you think they are a first-year program, which only really has one FBS-level recruiting class in.
I was going to say, it is really quite a ride this year for UD. And you mentioned that there was an overtime win against the UConn team that wound up going 9-3, dramatic homecoming win over Louisiana Tech. But then you pair it with heartbreaking loss to Western Kentucky that they probably could have, would have, should have won, or at least got to overtime. And then kind of a baffling loss at 2-10, Sam Houston.
Yeah, that was the really bad one. That was a bad one. Yeah.
But obviously there was just so many storylines this year and so many ups and downs that in terms of interest, as you said, I think maybe this is what people didn't understand about moving up to FBS. It's very different than the FCS level.
It's a lot more competitive, and you know, one thing I did appreciate, Tom, was that I think Delaware fans did respond. You know, there was a lot of concern about, oh geez, you know, are Delaware fans going to come to games? You know, they're still not coming to games the way they did 20 years ago, but it's a different time, you know, with social media and so many games on TV and things like that. There were really nice crowds at Delaware Stadium. I mean, there were some great atmospheres for some of those games. The UConn game, the Friday night Western Kentucky game, where Delaware almost beat one of the best teams in the league, a Western Kentucky team that's often been one of the best teams in the league. Yeah, the crowds were great. I think Delaware ended up third in the league in attendance, which is a nice accomplishment for them.
And it's interesting because you mentioned that the home piece of things. One thing that did stand out about their record this year is 5-1 at home, 1-5 on the road. Does that perhaps speak to the more challenging travel in Conference USA and tougher non-conference trips to places like Colorado and Wake Forest?
Yeah, I think you're right, Tom. I mean, you know, those are all long road trips. You know, Delaware's closest road trip was Liberty, and they got blown out in that one. You know, one of the interesting things that I noticed was if you look at the Conference USA standings, Delaware's kind of right smack in the middle, 4-4 in the league, 6-6 overall. There's two teams behind them in the standings who they lost to, and there's two teams ahead of them in the standings that they beat. Like, that really just kind of shows you how competitive this level of football is. And there's such a fine line, such a small margin for error, that's really going to determine which way it goes for you. You know, that Western Kentucky loss, two bad turnovers, an interception and a fumble, just doomed Delaware. And, you know, I mean, they still lost a really close game, but You know, you can always kind of pick out a couple things like, okay, if that hadn't happened, it might have gone the other way.
you mentioned the home crowds that they saw, and we mentioned the 5-1 record. Is that perhaps one thing looking forward Delaware may have as an advantage? Is that home field advantage that they may have something there that will help them stand out and perform well in Conference USA?
Yeah, I think, yeah, that's a good point, Tom. You know as well as anybody, Delaware's stature as a football program nationally, from its great success under three straight Hall of Fame coaches, Bill Murray, Dave Nelson, and Tubby Raymond, you know, and then under a perhaps future Hall of Fame coach, Casey Keeler. This is a nationally recognized program. It's a program that's got winning in its blood, and that's why it has a dedicated fan base. I mean, it was always one of the top draws attendance-wise at the level at which it was playing, Division II, 1AA, FCS, and we're seeing that stature carry over a little bit in terms of people do want to see them. And I think they're going to build that. I think they're going to build that as they continue to get better in Conference USA.
Before we talk about what's next for UD, let's talk about the kind of short term what's next, which is the bowl game that's coming up. The Hens Bowl destination will be announced this Sunday. Is there a sense of where they might go? Obviously, it's going to be one of the earlier, perhaps smaller bowls, but any sense of where and who they could be playing?
Yeah, I mean, I did a little column where I made five predictions, and I had them playing Georgia Southern at the bowl game, at the Myrtle Beach Bowl, in one of them. You know, there's one bowl game that used to be the Bahamas Bowl that is going to be a bowl game somewhere with some name that they haven't figured out yet. I have them maybe playing Coastal Carolina in that one, wherever it is. You know, there's a couple of those bowl games in Alabama. I think one in Mobile, one in Montgomery. I think they could end up in one of those, maybe against an Arkansas State or a Texas State. I think it's very likely they'll play a Sun Belt Conference team. But I also kind of threw out the Boca Raton Bowl in Florida is also one that could take a Conference USA team. That would be a nice place to go, Florida, over the holidays. And I also kind of threw that one in there as a possibility, playing Central Michigan, a MAC team. But I think the odds are that they will get a Sun Belt Conference team somewhere down south where it's probably a little bit warmer than here. But Coastal Carolina as a possible matchup would be interesting because that's next year's opening night opponent at Delaware Stadium. And Coastal Carolina just fired its coach. They made a bowl, but they just fired their coach. So we'll see what happens there.
It is always interesting this time of year to see what some
Oh,
teams are
my
doing
goodness.
without a coach or with a new coach, or yeah, at least the one thing the Hens do have is that level of stability. And speaking of that, ultimately, how big is a bowl bid to building momentum both with fans and then obviously with recruiting?
It's absolutely huge, Tom. The fact that the fact that Delaware has already been on national TV five times this year has certainly expanded their brand. We hear that word all the time now, their brand. It certainly has brought an incredible exposure to the university and to the football program. And a bowl game is just going to add to that. It's just going to add to that. Prospective recruits are going to see that. Prospective transfers are going to see that. The portal's going to open in early January, and it's going to be a revolving door, of course, as it always is now, and that will certainly help Delaware in terms of attracting some additional players who could maybe help them.
And I imagine for fans, if it is somewhere like Myrtle Beach or Boca Raton, it may not be, but if it is a place like that, it's certainly better than, let's say, Northern Iowa or Missoula, Montana, right? I mean, it's a place to go for a postseason game.
Yeah, no doubt about it. It was kind of interesting. I mean, I like a lot of people, Saturday night was staying up watching the Alabama Auburn game because if Alabama beats Auburn, that opens the door for Delaware because it means Auburn doesn't have a sixth win. So it was so strange kind of going through that kind of experience, but it was cool. It was fun. And I know a lot of people kind of enjoyed being on the edge of their seat, kind of seeing how that thing would turn out. It was a little bit in the past, like in the past where Delaware would lose to Villanova, like they always would, and then suddenly find themselves on the bubble and, oh, did New Hampshire win? Did this school win? Did this school lose? Did Southeast Louisiana win? You're kind of looking at the other results to see if it's going to open a door or if it's going to close a door. And often that had a lot to do with it, with if Delaware didn't or did get in the FCS playoffs in recent years. So that's what we were doing again. This time it was a bowl, not a playoff berth.
Well, I do want to look ahead a little bit because you mentioned the transfer portal. How much does that NIL affect UD as they now really dive into FBS full force? Particularly as it looks for players and perhaps maybe loses some players in this whole mix.
They've already Zach Marker, who was the starting quarterback the first game and then got hurt on the first play of the second series, has already said he's going to go in the transfer portal. That's just part of college football nowadays. You're going to lose some guys, but you're also going to get some guys. Certainly you want to keep who you can, the guys who've been most valuable. Delaware's had some players who had great years. Nick Minicucci had a great year as quarterback, as it turned out. One of the leading passers in the country. Good runner, good passer. They still have him coming back, so that's great. It'll be interesting to see how they kind of replenish what they lose on the offensive line. I think they're going to have to get better on defense. It'll be interesting to see what they do there in terms of adding transfers. They're going to announce a big recruiting class this week, probably at least like 20 kids. A bunch of freshmen helped them this year. One of them caught a touchdown pass against UTEP. One of them had an interception on the first play of the game. So there's going to be some incoming kids who could probably help them right off the bat too. You want to build your depth at this level. It's important. But yeah, it's going to be fun to see what they do and who they add and again who they might lose because they will lose some people too. Everybody does.
Yeah, particularly if you've got any kind of glut at any kind of position, people start to think, well, if you're a running back, am I going to get enough carries? If I'm a receiver, am I going to get enough catches? It's a different world now.
Exactly. Yep. No doubt about it.
So I do want to talk a little bit about Delaware State University and what an amazing year for DSU under first-year head coach DeSean Jackson. From 1-11 to 8-4, and essentially really one win short of their first MEAC title since 2007 and a trip to a bowl of their own, the Celebration Bowl, which pits the MEAC and the SWAC champion against each other. And much like I said at the start with Ryan Carty and UD officials, I imagine even the most optimistic DSU fans and officials could not have maybe foreseen this type of year from DeSean Jackson and the Hornets in year one.
Without a doubt, Tom. I mean, even though they had a chance to win the league championship and didn't get it in that South Carolina State game to end the season, they are absolutely thrilled with everything that happened this year. They rolled the dice when they hired DeSean. They really rolled the dice. I mean, he'd coached one season of high school football as an assistant. And I'm kind of writing something about this right now. Name recognition is great and it's going to attract some players and things like that. And it certainly did with DeSean, but you got to do what you got to do to get the right players, to get the right coaching staff, and motivate and develop those players and have the right schemes in place to be successful. And they did. They did what they had to do in terms of creating a winning team with the coaches and the schemes that they employed. And that's where they really deserve a lot of credit, because just being a former famous player isn't going to guarantee anything if you can't coach them up. You got to coach them up.
And there's an apples-to-apples example in the MEAC with Michael Vick. I mean, he came in, same thing, name recognition.
Right.
They did not have quite the season that Delaware State did, despite, again, pretty much kind of the same type of figure coming into the situation there.
Exactly. Good point, Tom. Yeah. I forget what they finished. 2-10. Is that what? It didn't work out as well for them. I know, Michael Vick fired his defensive coordinator a week and a half before the Del State game. So obviously, he didn't have the right infrastructure in place the way the Hornets did. When Delaware State came into Delaware on opening night, and of course Delaware won. But it was like more competitive than people thought. And Delaware State like really ran the ball effectively. And people were like, whoa, is this an aberration? Is Delaware not ready? Is Delaware State better than expected? Delaware State was better than expected. There were signs right away that they were better, that they were more ready to compete and compete successfully. It's going to be interesting to see what they do next year, who they add as players. One thing I'm really looking forward to seeing is whom they schedule. They had two wins over Division II schools this year. You can't do that. You gotta do better than that and put yourself in a position where if you make it to the Celebration Bowl, great. But if you don't, you're in the FCS playoff conversation. And you're not going to do that playing Bowie State in Southern Connecticut State. You got to play Richmond or Lehigh or William & Mary or Youngstown State or somebody like that in your non-conference games.
To your point about scheme, I mean, it is interesting that the offense under Jackson, who is best known as a receiver, was a running identity, which does speak to the fact that he understood the assignment and put the best product out there to win games.
Yeah, they did a nice job. The young offensive coordinator who'd been a former Bowie State quarterback and an offensive coordinator at the Division II level, and had done a couple years interning with the Cleveland Browns. They did a real nice job in terms of creating a system that would work for them, and it worked for them. I mean, they were the leading rushing team in the country. Now, again, they still had some games where, hey, we're not getting it. We got to get it some other way, whether it's through throwing the ball or whether it's through just playing better defense. They end up winning this kind of excruciating game, 14-12, at Morgan State, thanks to some turnovers and some penalties and a missed field goal. So you got to get them any way you can get them, right?
For sure. And like UD, the question here is really sustainability in the era of NIL and the transfer portal. How much does having this kind of season out of the gate, paired with DeSean Jackson's name recognition, maybe give him a little bit of a leg up in trying to keep this thing sustainable, maybe getting as many players back in through the transfer portal as he may lose through the portal?
And as great a possible destination as DSU turned out to be last year after they hired Deshaun, when a whole bunch of kids all of a sudden said, "Yeah, I'm going there," whether they be high school seniors or transfers, even more are likely going to say that now that they've seen the success that they had right off the bat. So it's important that he makes this team even better and gets the right guys and gets the kids with character and gets the kids who want to get an education and gets the kids who are going to be coachable and make the right contributions to culture. The word you always hear now with college sports programs, you got to have the right culture. And making sure they get the right guys who can contribute to that. They certainly did a good job last year. I mean, again, last year he was hired after the first recruiting period had kind of ended. The first signing day had already been done, but they still managed to get some freshmen who helped a lot and some transfers who helped a lot too. And that was because of Deshaun's name recognition and the connections that he had. They should really be able to build on that now.
Kevin, is the biggest danger for DSU perhaps losing DeSean Jackson before
They're
they
going to
fully
lose him.
capitalize? I guess they're going to lose him, but trying to capitalize on what they have with him in Dover, I imagine they are pushing to do some facilities here and get some money both from the state and fundraising. But the clock is ticking. I mean, The Athletic even listed him as a kind of long shot for the job at his alma mater, Cal. He probably won't get that, but the fact that his name is out there already. I mean, it does make you wonder how long can DSU's got to strike while the iron's hot, right?
Exactly. They're only going to keep him for a couple of years. Especially if they're good if they're good again next year. I think the fact that that Dion, hasn't exactly set the world on fire against at Colorado, might tone down that a little bit. I don't think Eddie George had a great first year at Bowling Green. So you gotta prove you can do it, and you also got to make the right next step. You can't. Like Cal, that's kind of a reach for Deshaun to jump to an ACC. It sounds so weird saying Cal's in the ACC, but that's a huge jump. But from Dell State to perhaps a group of five school somewhere, especially in the South, or in California, where he's got great connections. I mean, it's going to be interesting. It's going to be interesting to see, but it's going to happen at some point. Again, they got to keep having success. He's going to get lured somewhere else, but he will have left Delaware State better than he found it, and that should allow Delaware State administrators to find the right person, to have a better chance to find the right person to keep that going.
Thanks to News Journal Delaware online sports writer Kevin Tressolini for joining us on The Green this week. Next up, Art's Playlist and a preview of a holiday performance of Handel's Messiah in Sussex County. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. One of Southern Delaware's oldest musical organizations and one of its newest take the stage together next weekend when the Southern Delaware Chorale and Sodello, the Southern Delaware Orchestra, team up for a performance of Handel's Messiah. On this edition of Arts Playlist, Delaware Public Media's Martin Matheny is joined by Sodello's board president, Steve Greifer, to discuss this upcoming performance.
Let me start by just asking you to kind of tell me about this performance and how this came about.
Well, it's really a unique performance, and it's a great illustration of the power of community music and community arts in Southern Delaware. We are remarkably similar groups in that the Southern Delaware Chorale started with their founder moving down to the Southern Delaware area and realizing that there was nobody to sing the Hallelujah Chorus with. And she came down here, saw the need, and started to bring together a group of friends. And this performance, 40 years later, is a celebration of those friends coming together and the longevity of the group and the passion for choral music and classical music. And the background for Sodelo is exactly the same. I moved down here 4 or 5 years ago. There was nobody to play classical music with. There was no string group. So Eva Del Gallo and I formed the orchestra. The only difference between the two of us is that we're 4 years old and they're 40 years old. So when it came time for their celebration, they saw really the opportunity to celebrate that idea of longevity and community service. And it was a natural for us to come together and perform. And we had our first rehearsal with the chorus was this past Monday night. The chorus has been practicing with Joey Shorthall, their music director, and we've been practicing with Jim Anderson, our music director, and everybody came together, prepared, and it was a, for nerds like me, a chill up your spine kind of evening.
What can people expect to see and hear when they come to these concerts?
Well, I think a lot of people are going to come to the concerts expecting the Hallelujah Chorus. And they're certainly going to get a very robust and enthusiastic Hallelujah Chorus from the stage. But it's really, as you well know, an amazing piece of music. And there are so many different ways that the people on stage perform together. So there's the full orchestra and the full chorus. And we often have pieces that we play together there. Then there's a group of people within the orchestra where the marking in the score is senza ripieno, and that means without the full orchestra. So we have the first and second stands of the various string sections playing together with select winds. And then we also have times when there are single soloists playing from the chorus. So it's really coming at us in every way possible. And it's so exciting that we go back and forth within a piece of music, or we're probably playing 15 or 20 different pieces, including the Hallelujah Chorus. I think a lot of the melodies will be familiar, and a lot of the words will also be familiar for people that grew up with this piece.
Yeah, that's worth mentioning. The Messiah is in English, so no subtitles, supertitles, or anything like that needed.
I believe that in every country where the Messiah is performed, which I would say is every place that there's a couple of violins that want to play together with their singing friends, the words have been translated into the language of the host country, which is really underscoring what is so important about the Messiah. Is it's about bringing people together. It's about celebrating a common joy, whether or not you're a Christian. The idea of salvation and people coming together and people celebrating together and raising their voices together is something that's universal. And that's one of the things that is so joyous about a performance of the Messiah in English or in French or in German, and whether it's here in Southern Delaware or anywhere else in the world.
One thing I love about the Messiah, and you touched on this, it is a large work, and it's such a dynamic work because it's not just always orchestra and chorus going full out the whole time. There's sort of elements of chamber music, elements of a very soloistic performance. And as you said, the Hallelujah Chorus is the most famous part, but there is more to the work. And I wonder, just personally, what are some of your favorite bits of the Messiah?
Well, you know, I have to say, and it's pretty cliche, but I have to say it's the Hallelujah Chorus. And the reason I say that is not necessarily musically, but I grew up, when I played in an orchestra in high school, everybody that had graduated from our high school came back for the Christmas concert, whether their kids were on the stage or not, and they sang the Hallelujah Chorus. And I played in the pit orchestra for many, many years after I graduated. So it's those memories of coming together and how music impacts the feeling of togetherness and community and cooperation and reminds us in these days of the importance of crossing boundaries, of breaking down barriers, and of celebrating the joy of the music and the joy of the season. I also like And the Glory of the Lord, obviously. And if partly for the title and partly for the music, I like All We Like Sheep Have Gone Astray. And Lord knows that's true also, but there is some reconciliation and some resolution of that within the piece.
You know, almost every musician I've talked to in a variety of contexts over the years, they love getting to perform works that are chorus and orchestra. You know, singers love singing with the orchestra. Orchestras love playing with a choir. What makes performances like that so special for the performers?
When you have a piece like The Messiah and an opportunity for a performance like this is also wonderful. And then coming full circle to the 20 or so of us who started off as a small string ensemble as Sedello 4 years ago, adding in soloists and then adding in the winds, brass, and percussion, and now adding in a chorus, it's like we're continuing to build towards something that I wouldn't say we couldn't have imagined it, because we did dare to imagine it, but the fact that it's come together so quickly, and if I can say so beautifully in such a short amount of time, is a little bit of a holiday miracle in itself.
Yeah, and you know, to me, at its heart, music is about collaboration, and the more people you have collaborating, the more exciting the performance can be a lot of the time.
Well, and that's absolutely true, because everybody, and Monday night was a great example of many people meeting for the first time and just really getting behind Joey, hearing what they're doing, seeing how it all comes together. One other thing about collaboration that I just want to mention, there's a lot more to putting on a concert like this than learning the music and going up on stage. And having two different organizations come together to do the marketing, to do the logistics, to do all the arrangements, to motivating our membership to help fill the auditorium. That whole other side of it has also really been an exciting display of what community music and what community culture means in general, but I have to say, in particular, in Southern Delaware, this whole concept of community groups and community performances really is, in many ways, the primary way that we enjoy culture in Southern Delaware, and really at a high level of quality. So that collaboration on the stage, but also the collaboration behind the scenes, really builds to make this such an exciting event with a capital E, as opposed to just an exciting performance.
Parts of The Messiah, especially the Hallelujah Chorus, it's something that everybody has heard, but I want to underscore, if you've never seen it, if you've never been part of a live performance, it is a very magical experience.
And if you'll pardon me for bragging a little bit, I think it'll be that much more of a magical experience being at K. Penlopen High School, being in the community that people live in, having a relationship with the people that are up there on the stage. It really is a culmination of what we as musicians and performers and actors are trying to do here in Southern Delaware, which is enjoy what we're performing, but bring along the people that want to see it. And very importantly, to your point, we're trying to, as you've heard me say too many times, spread the joy of orchestral/classical music throughout the area. And you're absolutely right. It's an inspiring piece to hear, whether it's in your headphones or whether it's watching it on a screen. But when you walk through those doors before the conductor raises his baton, there's already a buzz of excitement in the room. And it's going to be electrical. It'll be unlike, frankly, anything that the chorus has performed before or that Sedello has performed before. And it's the power of the audience coming together with our groups that's going to make it such a magical performance.
After The Messiah, the orchestra gets a little bit of time off, but what's coming up next year?
Our spring concert, which will be in March, will be the New World Symphony by Dvorak. It'll be some Mozart. We're back and forth between Don Giovanni and the Magic Flute. We'll have a soprano soloist performing with us. So it will be one of our more classical concerts. We mix pure classical concerts with largely pop concerts, with hybrid concerts. And I think that this concert that's coming up in April is going to be a great example of that hybrid between pure classical and things that people already are familiar with and know and love.
Thanks to Southern Delaware Orchestra Board President Steve Greifer and our Martin Matheny for joining us on Arts Playlist. Sodello teams up with the Southern Delaware Chorale for a performance of Handel's Messiah Saturday, September 13th at K-Penn Lopen High School. More information and tickets are available at sodellomusic.org. More information and tickets are available at sodellomusic.org. And that's a wrap on this edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. You can also sign up for our weekly newsletter there by clicking newsletters at the top of the page. And remember, The Green is also available via podcast at our website, as well as Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and the NPR and Delaware Public Media apps. Thanks to all those who helped make this week's show possible, contributor John Hurdle and Delaware Public Media's Martin Matheny. For them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Byrne saying thanks for joining us this week. And we'll see you again next week here on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind. Hi, I'm Delaware Public Media News Director Tom Byrne, host of The Green. Thanks for listening this week. I just want to take a moment to remind you Delaware Public Media is in the midst of its year-end fund drive, and we still need your support for The Green and our local news coverage. We're proud of The Green. It's won local and national awards for bringing you stories and interviews focused solely on the First State. Our staff and contributors cover a wide spectrum of topics and issues, from politics and the environment to education and the arts. But that doesn't happen without you, the public in Delaware Public Media. If you value what The Green brings you each week and want to keep it going, please take some time to show it by supporting our year-end fund drive. We are trying to fill the loss of federal funding. For us, that means $165,000 per year each year going forward. So please, head to DelawarePublic.org right now and donate. And again, thank you for listening to The Green here on Delaware Public Media.